and we're the children from Kent Hill Junior School Radio Club.
This is our documentary programme about a devastating tragedy from 1953, which affected many people along the east coast of United Kingdom and northern Europe. Canvey Island was hit quite badly. 58 residents lost their lives and 13,000 people were evacuated. Our documentary tells a story of what happened, and we will also explore the possibility of it happening again, today or in the near future.
As far as Britain is concerned, the Atlantic Ocean is the most significant area in weather determination, and it was a ship's report from the Atlantic that first identified the developing depression that was to wreak havoc over Britain as January passed into February 1953.
Through the night of Thursday to Friday, the depression moved towards Britain, and its potential was perceived to be that of a bad storm. But during the night of Friday to Saturday, the depression made a sudden southeastern lunge down over the North Sea.
Large tracts of the Great Scottish Forests were destroyed, with the number of trees falling in a couple of hours equal to the total amount cold in a year. Wind speeds rose to 125 miles per hour, and the average was 90 miles per hour. The great storm soon began to claim its first victims.
The Fleetwood trawler Michael Griffiths vanished with its 15-man crew into the boiling sea, somewhere off the Hebrides. The Princess Victoria Rail ferry sunk in the Irish Sea, with great loss of lives, including older women and children who had been thrown into the sea when their lifeboat overturned as it was being launched. Ocean-going liners were trapped in ports as far apart as Liverpool and Southampton. Wise precautions, as 10 ships were lost during the gale.
The Meteorological Office issued warnings of the northern gales of exceptional severity, but this was hardly the right preparation for the catastrophe that was to follow. All reports point to the sea bursting in unexpectedly on its victims. High tides predicted along the North Sea coast, and these were in turn to be topped by a wall of water of 10 feet in height, which is known as the storm surge, blown down the North Sea by the terrifying gale. The massive surge drove into the ever-increasing bottleneck of the North Sea. The gale forced an estimated 4 billion cubic yards of Atlantic water southwards towards Essex.
The flood had begun.
By early Saturday evening, 6,000 people were evacuated from the Lincolnshire coast, whilst 36 perished. The sea defence on the north coast of Norfolk were completely overwhelmed and 80 drowned. The sea poured into Yarmouth, flooding over 35,000 homes and 10 people drowned.
The great tide, still not at its highest point, rolled southwards towards Essex and the Thames estuary. In Great Wakerim, one elderly couple found it too difficult to try and climb onto the roof. They managed to get their disabled son up safely, but the woman physically couldn't climb the awkward arch roof. The couple decided to get back inside their home and stood on the stove. The people outside could hear them singing, "Abide with me," as the waters rose higher and higher until there was silence.
Every Essex coastal community has tales to tell of disaster, heroism and death. Jay Wick, Harwich, Foulness, Walton, Southend, the list goes on.
But as the flood surge entered the Thames estuary, it saved its final devastating blow for the community of Canvey Island, which stood defenceless in its path.
The island lacked adequate protection and the land was below sea level. Within seconds, the inhabitants of Canvey Island were literally fighting for their lives as the sea burst upon them like a waterfall.
It was a raging torrent, all manner of things carried by it, including a caravan, several sheds, and any amount of heavy timber, and several water tanks which knocked against walls and doors like battering rams.
The door just flew open and the icy water poured in. All around us, people were screaming for help.
Within 15 minutes, more than 6 square miles had been engulfed.
Families were awakened by the sudden roar as the wall burst, by the swish of the water as it rushed past, by the clatter and crash of debris striking the house, by the noise of splitting timber and splintering glass.
Half awake, dazed and bewildered as they struggled to escape, to reach the outdoor staircases, to their lofts, or to fight their way through the tumult outside, or to go to the aid of relatives or neighbours. Successive waves charging through the broke sea walls, sweeping them off their feet.
Many who clambered on chairs, tables, cookers, stepladders to keep their heads above water, or to make holes in the ceilings to escape into the roof spaces, found their support swept away from under their feet, leaving them fighting in the dark with the floating furniture, clutching desperately at fanlights or at the top of doors and wardrobes and trying to hold children above the suffocating water.
The sunken marsh areas of the island became known as the Basin of Death.
The death toll of Canvey Island that Sunday morning was 58. Many others died in days after the tragedy, their lives cut short by the extreme conditions they had endured.
Canvey was a town in the sea, a grey, grim, sad place. Sad because as I saw the dead fowls in the waters still come slow down the street in rowboats.
And especially sad because at times there were still women trying to push back past the police and soldiers to go wading themselves into search of their own missing or dead.
The worst thing was finding the bodies of people you had known all your life. We had to lay out about 18 to 20 bodies on the pavement to be identified. The people I actually knew, you can't imagine what it was like.
By Sunday night, some 40,000 people from East Coast were sheltering in makeshift rescue centres, school, church halls, village halls, social clubs, holiday clubs, pubs, hotels, boarding houses, army camps, factory hostels.
Even those who had not been physically affected had seen unimaginable sights before their eyes.
Foulness and Canvey Island had still become half submerged of shore islands, with many of their residents still a day or so from rescue. The Essex coast was virtually submerged, while central London caught the tail end of the catastrophe, with the water lapping to the top of the embankment parapets.
But the early hours of Sunday morning, the wind changed and the surge swung away across the North Sea towards Holland, where a far greater disaster threatened, culminating in the loss of 1,800 lives and massive tracts of land to the sea.
But here in Essex on that Sunday morning, devastation and suffering faced those people fortunate to have survived the terror of the flood. Scenes were to follow of rescue, evacuation, devastation and looting, and the attempts to restore some kind of civil order, including the total evacuation of Canvey Island.
This is a letter from George Smith. We lived on the corner of Coker Ormsby Road, of Haven Road. My dad, a builder, he built our bungalow 3 foot above ground level. He must have known something was going to happen. Anyway, I woke up in the night and went to my bedroom window to see water everywhere instead of the fields surrounding our bungalow. Not understanding why this should be, I ran to my Mum and Dad's bedroom, shouting, "There's all water outside my bedroom." Begrudgingly, my mum and Dad got up and went to look out their bedroom window. All water there too. I woke my younger brother up, Eddie, and all went to the kitchen and made a cup of tea. Whilst Dad got on the phone, I was surprised that the phone was still working. Dad said that if we were quick, Farmer Jolks Norris would take us to Benfleet on his lorry. I would be 6 in 2 weeks' time. Eddie was 4. Mum was pregnant with my youngest brother, Bobby, to be born in July. We had loads of rabbits and chickens up in the garden. All were lost except one pregnant rabbit that Dad had to go to rescue, and we took with us. So there we were, carrying all we could with us, up to the top of the road where, true his word was, Jack Norris and his family and a few others all jumping into the back of the lorry, which proceeded to make its way cautiously to Benfleet station. All very exciting for an almost 6-year-old boy, although I didn't realise the devastation, death and misery that had happened until later. We went up to London to stay with my mum's mother for about a month. I even had to go to school there, and the rabbit had her youngsters while we were in London. I too remember the parcels of the sultanas, etc., that we got while we returned to the primary school on Long Road. Also, I still remember the garishly patterned carpet that we were given. In general, my memories of the island are a bit sketchy, but a couple of months remain quite vivid to this day.
This is an account from Pauline Sexton.
At the time of the flood, I was 15 years old and lived at Gafton Road. Every Saturday, my mum, dad, sister and I used to go round to see friends of ours who lived in Herbert Road, just off of May Avenue. We left just before 12 o'clock that night and got to Lakeside Corner, where we stood saying our goodbyes. It was a really lovely evening. It was a bit chilly, but the moon was shining nicely. I suggested I walk round the sea wall, but two policemen came up to us on their bikes and said, "It's getting a bit late, ladies and gentlemen. Perhaps you should be getting a move on home."
So we went home instead and went off to bed. In the early hours of the morning, I heard something banging on the side of my bedroom wall. At the back of our bungalow, backing onto my bedroom, was a coal shed, and the water had filled it up, and the coal was floating about and was hitting against the wall.
I woke my sister and her friend, who was staying over. We turned the light on and realised we were flooded and thought maybe someone had left a tap running or something. I banged on the other wall to Mum and Dad's room, where Mum shouted back that she was coming. We shouted back to her not to get out of bed as we were flooded. We all got up and dressed as the water gradually subsided. When it was still a few inches deep, we were walking about barefooted. Mum began trying to get rid of the water by bailing it out of the kitchen window with a saucepan. This was no use, of course, as she was throwing it out whilst even more was coming in.
The Air Force came and helped us off the island by lorry, and we all went to stay with my auntie and uncle in Southend until we were able to return.
Letter from Frederick and Dorothy Taylor. Dear Ivory, Friday the 30th Jan, the gale continued throughout the night. Saturday morning, the wind was stronger throughout the day. The power of the gale increased enormously. The elements were wild, the wind roared. We turned into bed at 11 with the gale still increasing, little realising the hail to come. I thank God from the bottom of my heart I was off duty of that night. Had I not been, your mother would have been drowned in her sleep. Between 1:30 a.m. and 2 a.m. I was awakened by the bashing wind and cries of assistance. I dressed and woke your mother, who was snoring. I told her to get dressed. The sea burst upon us with a great roar. Quickly, the bed was covered. I got your mother onto the table. To reach higher grounds, we left the bungalow neck high in water. We battled together in the raging, roaring torrent. We reached Miss Wood's bungalow across the road. I got your mother through the gates onto the steps of Miss Wood's bungalow. The sea roared around us. It crept higher still. How to keep our heads above water became a grand problem. It was here your mother rose to the occasion. With my assistance, she climbed on the top of the rainwater tanks. How she managed this, I do not know. I quickly climbed up behind her. Gradually, the cries for help died away, and one by one the light in the bungalow went out. Under the full moon, your great mother and myself were alone to their ailments. At last, the tide turned and slowly the water raced away, but the icy, roaring gale continued. Your mother had come to the end of her endurance and wished to take a chance to return to our bungalow. We got down off the tanks. Water was up to our arms, and in crossing the road, your mother was almost swept away from me. At last, we got inside our bungalow, which was flooded and out of the bitterly cold wind. The furniture was ruined. We stood in the cold water, almost dead. After a short rest, I went out with the water waist high to reach Grandma. At the bottom of the garden, I was in danger of drowning. Water up to my neck, three soldiers pulled me out onto the wall. Whole bungalows had been swept away. I found it impossible to reach Grandma's. I returned home but was unable to reach it, owing to the next incoming tide. I was taken by boat to the side door, where your mother and I rowed back to the wall. With all the other victims, we followed the wall, getting around the obstacles. At one part of the wall ahead was crumbling, and we got by just in time as the sea barrier is it down. At last, we reached the main road, packed tight with traffic. 10 miles of it. We boarded a bus and are taken to Hadley. Here tea, sandwiches and clothing were issued. The relief system was wonderful. It was not till last Wednesday we learnt of the sad passing of your grandmother and Uncle Will. Please excuse no records of your birthday owing to events. Please accept our greeting with this. It's been snowing today. We visited Miss Roach in Southend Hospital. She lived next door to Mother. She was the woman who lived on the table for 4 days. Kind regrets to all. Best wishes to you, hoping to see you on Thursday. Mother and Fred.